start with questions. Sid Gilbert, Francis Bonner, Tom Irvine, and Cliff Swartz got together with me to go over plans for the thing originally. And they helped me with these questions. I had a long list to take that down. So that there'd be some structure initially. Suppose we go through the early questions, and then you can free float from there. I don't want you to be confined by those.
All right, and how do you want to start? You want to start by my trying the question?
Yes.
Marvin Kushner. Department of Pathology, and currently Professor and Dean Emeritus of the School of Medicine. I came to Stony Brook in 1970. It was to be July, but there was no place to put me until September. And so I waited out at Montauk, where we had a house, and came here in September.
That was in the Surge building?
In the Surge building.
How old were you then?
I was 51. Okay. And I had been at New York University, where I had been professor of pathology and director of laboratories at Bellevue Hospital and University Hospital. I would guess that Ed Pellegrino was most responsible for my coming to Stony Brook. He was the one who called me and asked me if I would find, if I might find this new school attractive. And I was interviewed about coming here by him and by Arthur Upton. At the time I came, it wasn't quite clear in my mind or in theirs what exactly they wanted from me, except to, I knew they wanted me to establish a service and research department of pathology. And in discussions that we had, one evening in New York City at an Italian restaurant, Ed Pellegrino and Arthur Upton and I had dinner together. And Arthur, who was then professor and chairman of the Department of Pathology and acting dean for the School of Basic Sciences, which was a separate school at that time, Arthur suggested that he was finding the job of director of dean of the School of Basic Sciences intriguing and interesting and challenging, and why wouldn't I consider being chairman of the Department of Pathology? He would step out of that position and continue on as the real dean, not simply the acting dean. He had followed
Basic Health Sciences.
No, it was called just the School of Basic Sciences.
Basic Sciences. What now? What were they?
They encompassed
not physics, chemistry, and biology.
No,
no.
They were anatomy, physiology, microbiology, pathology, pharmacology, and a split responsibility with the dean of biology or biological sciences for the Department of Biochemistry, which predated the School of Medicine, actually, and the School of Basic Science.
I see.
That position had been held by Al Knudsen before Arthur.
I see.
And when Knutson left, Arthur took over.
Do you know why Al Knutson left?
Only hearsay. I was not here at the time he left. But my understanding was that he had been here, I think, since 1966, had collaborated with Ed Pellegrino in the establishment of the school and the drawing of plans, and was becoming somewhat impatient in the sense that he knew it was going to take a few more years before this entity actually came into existence. And I believe I was told that he left because he wanted to get on with his professional career at NASA. And that was one. Why did I come? Well, I had been professor of pathology and director of laboratories at Bellevue since 1954. And we had, I thought, an extraordinary department, considering that the physical facilities left a lot to be desired. You know, we worked in the old Bellevue Hospital mortuary building. The new school building was an improvement, but even that was short of space. And I was not chairman of the department at NYU. I had worked under William Von Glahn, under Lou Thomas, and under Al Stetson. And when one gets to be 50, one gets restless. I had decided that it would be challenging to look for some other expansion of my responsibilities, in particular to run a department, to recruit new people, and to pioneer a new effort. The of course, when one gets, I said to my wife, now I'm 50, and I got to make up my mind to change something in my life, either my job or my wife. And she said, well, change your job. So I've always been fond of the island. We've been coming out to vacation out here since 1948. Indeed, it was hard for me to believe that people worked in Suffolk County with vacation there.
Right.
And but it was, I had been aware of the development of the school and the plans for it, and I was quite excited about the prospect of coming here.
How did you know Ed Pellegrino?
Oh, Ed had been a junior. Ed was behind me at medical school. He was a year behind me at medical school. I knew him then. I knew him on the wards at Bellevue before he went to Flemington. I knew him at when he was in Kentucky. He had offered me the job of professor of pathology there, and I planned the laboratories for him, but with him. But I decided not to go as chairman of the department down there. It's hard to remember exactly why I refused. I think a large part of it may have been Lou Thomas's responsibility. When I said to him, I have this offer to go with Ed, and I had other offers, but this seemed particularly attractive because here again was a new school that was being developed down there. And he said to me, not you, not at this time. And it's sort of like, now, coach, now. I never.
Willis Thomas, The Lives of Himself.
Yes, yeah. He was the chairman of the department and then eventually became dean at NYU. At any rate, this was very attractive to me. It was absolutely carte blanche. It seemed to me that the state was thoroughly behind this effort. There was a real sense of support from Albany. This was the first medical school that the state was to develop on its own from the very beginning. All the other three had been takeovers from pre-existing schools. And
did you ever see the Muir report in your your commission report?
At that time, I did not. I've seen it since and has. Even the temporary laboratories that were planned in the on the South Campus were extraordinarily attractive. Laboratory modules were large, 600 square feet. The offices were windowed and looked out on bucolic surroundings. So I found the whole, and then I was told to recruit a large department, a department that was to be almost 20 individuals in size in the faculty, because of the fact that we were to have responsibility for service work in this hospital, as well as the teaching of pathology and research effort in pathology. I had very little hesitation. As a matter of fact, when I look at the current efforts at recruitment and what goes into them, with the negotiations and bargaining back and forth, and the assurances of support, and how much money do I have for this, and how much money do I have for this, I'm a little startled. Because as I recall, after I spoke to Ed and Arthur at that dinner meeting in New York, I said, well, I'm going to think about this. I went home, and I think Ed called me the next day on the telephone. He said, how about it? You want to come as chairman of the department? And I said, yes. And that was it. And it was sort of, I didn't even know in detail what it was that I was going to get, but I knew that this is something I wanted to do.
But you're
now it takes a long courtship. It takes a year to get a chairman of a department, at least.
Yeah. Did you recruit Orrin Ackerman?
Not, well, he sort of recruited himself, I suspect. What happened with Lauren was that he came to retirement at Washington University. And he is of the school that believes that when you retire, you move away from your previous place. I think it was particularly important for him because he was such a dominant figure that it would be impossible for any successor to function with him there. They would still be running to Papa. And so he had decided to move. I think his first discussions were with Arthur Upton. And then Arthur discussed it with me, and of course I had known Ackerman by reputation and personally for many years as one of the outstanding figures in American pathology. And I jumped at the opportunity and said, by golly, yes, of course. So he agreed, and I think he's had this has been a very fulfilling time for him.
I think so. I played off with him.
Well, he seems to, he enjoys this department. He has a lot of respect for the young people here. And of course, they worship him. And here he is, Lauren must be 84 now, perhaps. Maybe 85.
No, about 84.
And he has, he is still the last word on much of diagnostic surgical pathology. And in perhaps two areas, he's absolutely the last word internationally. That is bone tumors and breast tumors. And he's been an incredible ornament to our reputation. He's had days in which he says, well, I'm very big in Costa Rica today, and he'll show us the slides, the material that's sent to him for consultation from somewhere in the world. Off the record, of course, he also says he's an extraordinary golf player, which I never believe. You can testify. In other words, I think the factors that were most important in my decision was just the challenge, the newness, the opportunity to create something in an image that I would be meaningful and attractive.
after you've had experience, that are the way you get in an organization, you develop some ideas as to what you'd like to see, or what you would like to see done differently. And you begin to think, well, maybe I could do that. And I think it's quite natural for many people, at least, to want to strike out on their own and have some responsibility.
Well, the lack of responsibility was one of my problems. I had an enormous service that I ran at Bellevue, and perhaps in one of the most famous hospitals in the world, and then they gave me, in addition to that, the responsibility for the private hospital across the street, so that in all there was 1,200 beds. There were 1,200 beds at Bellevue and another 700 beds at the University Hospital, and we had a very busy service indeed, and we had a department at that time, which including everybody, which had 75 people at professorial rank. And I would guess that with the chairman, I probably split the responsibility for that department. So it wasn't that I was looking for more in the way of responsibility. I think I was looking perhaps for the opportunity to be almost smaller, but more tightly involved with the day-to-day activities of the institution. I should say that when one came here, there was a lot of rhetoric that surrounded the founding of the medical school. We were going to be different in a number of ways, many of which I found puzzling, and I had a sort of wait-and-see attitude toward them. The reason for it is that I never had a sense of being terribly critical of the classical formulations in medical education, both at the undergraduate and graduate level. So when Ed spoke about some of his ideas, the multi-track kind of training that he apparently envisaged, the fact that he would educate nurses and allied health professionals and dentists and physicians together, and then they would peel off at different times in their training, seemed a little unrealistic to me. I'm very chauvinistic, I would guess, is the word for what the requirements are for training a physician. And the medical school is a kind of apprenticeship. It substitutes almost for the old-fashioned form of training in which one worked alongside of a physician and learned that way. There has to be a kind of personality development that goes with it that makes it hard for me to see how one can train physicians as just a higher grade of technician. At any rate, I was always intrigued by the attempt to change the curriculum. And in the 60s, when much of the planning for this school took place, of course, there was a lot of ferment for change, just almost change for its own sake. There are two senior physicians who said things that amused and instructed me, I think, in regard to curriculum. One was Dickinson Richards, great professor of medicine, who was head of the medical service for Columbia at NYU and subsequently won the Nobel Prize, who used to quote Mr. Dooley and say, "It don't matter what you teach the children as long as they don't like it." And the other was another internist, Rafael Levine, who was chairman of the Department of Medicine at New York Medical College, who said one day to me at a meeting, Marvin, I have a wonderful idea for a curriculum. At that time, everybody was busy changing things around, and he said, you teach anatomy and biochemistry and physiology first, he said to me, then you teach pathology and microbiology and pathology. I'm sorry, pathology, microbiology, and pharmacology. I said, but Rocky, I said, that's what they did in Padua in 1500. He said, exactly. He said, that's what, I'll give them footnotes. Well, anyway, there is some reason to believe that the way you teach medicine is to start out by teaching the structure and function of the human body, and then go on from there to teach its aberrations and the things that cause these aberrations and what one does about them. And that seems like it's so logical that it's hard to begin to think about varying it. At NYU, at the time, there were certain changes that the faculty were interested in, and I was sort of amused by that, because there's nothing that substitutes for an enthusiastic instructor and a willing student. One of our associates said, you know, if you get a lousy poker hand, it doesn't matter what order the cards are dealt in, it's still a bad hand. And if you get a good hand, it doesn't matter either, it's still a good hand. So we were less hung up, perhaps, on the order, except that one year they had decided at NYU to try teaching anatomy in the second year instead of in the first year, which was sort of an incredible kind of attempt. They wanted to teach the approach to the patient first. One of our young cynics got up and he cussed himself and said, now, he said to the class, I'm percussing thing number one over here, and there's thing number two over here, but don't worry about what it is. We'll tell you about that next week. Well, some of the tortured attempts at curriculum reform seem to me to be of that order. And I remain a kind of classicist in terms of how the curriculum should be constructed. The content, of course, is enormously different from what it was 50-some-odd years ago when I started in medicine. Well, exactly 50 years now, 1939. But the structure, the skeleton on which this is based, I think, it remains the same.
And the human skeleton hasn't changed.
That's true. That's right. Exactly right. The other thing that hasn't changed is the quality of an outstanding physician. And I think that one can't lecture this. I don't think one can lecture on how to be a caring physician, how to be compassionate, how to be involved with your patients. That you can do if you have to teach that, and I'm not sure you have to. Maybe the place where that kind of selection is made is initially in the admissions committee. If you were astute enough to pick people, after all, we're dealing with young adults. We're dealing with people in their early 20s. We're not dealing with children on what we think of. But it's hard to detect those qualities. But
you have to demonstrate them
exactly.
In the rounds.
Exactly. And to see a great clinician or great physician work is such an impressive thing. The students realize it, I think, after a while. You can see it in part in the physicians they pick for their family. They're full of insecurities. They are terribly anxious. And this is a feature of medical students. They need constant assurance that they're going to be capable of bearing this responsibility. People in desperate trouble are going to turn to them, and here they are just out of college. And they're all of a sudden supposed to begin to be advisors. What do you tell a patient that has, when the patient sits down in front of you and you have to tell the patient that he has cancer or she has cancer. And I think of my own teachers in that regard who used to say that treating that kind of, dealing with that kind of patient perhaps requires the highest exercise of the art, the idea that this patient needs constant support, that they have to be given some hope. That one comes into the room and says, well, we tried that yesterday, it didn't work, we have something else we're going to try today. And that the patient has to be indicated to the patient, okay, yes, you have a chronic disease, like a number of chronic diseases, you're going to have bad days, you're going to have good days, and we're going to try to multiply the good days and work together on this problem. Otherwise, the patient's running off for cures in Mexico, go to five other doctors, get mutilated surgically very often when there's no reason for it, get poisoned by drugs for which one would have to try hard to find some reasonable explanation. So those are things which are not included in the written curriculum, but are part of the gradual enlarging experience that a medical student should have. And I just don't think that you can design a curriculum that will improve on the fact that you give them a certain amount of basic information, and then you go on to show them how one handles clinical problems. Not all clinical problems, they're not going to be experts in all kinds of disease.
I should have told them to hold the call. Okay.
I guess they picked it up. Well, that was a bit of perhaps beyond what you require.
Well, that's great. This is exactly what I want you to do.
All right.
In other words, not be bound by the questions.
Now, the
I think you've covered six reasonably well. What about seven?
Well, my understanding of the purposes behind the creation was, in very practical terms, to fulfill a need that was perceived at that time of there being a shortage of health professionals at all levels, and including physicians. Sort of strange that within a decade that reversed itself, and people began to decide that we had too many physicians, which I have never been convinced of, by the way. I don't know how one accurately measures the demand for medical care and its reality. Also, that who decides who has a doctor, and how this is paid for. So.
Well, the Muir Commission report, I think they had done quite a little research on relations of the number of doctors to the population before they ever came here. I remember I had been on the job here in 62. About 2 months, when two people came into my office unannounced. One was Malcolm Muir, and one was Lester Evans. And they explained their purpose and what they wanted to do was to establish a comprehensive health science center on the campus of a growing institution, rather than put it someplace where the administration was already set with a lot of traditions, and it would be hard for the existing establishment to take on something different and do justice to it. And they were looking for a situation like that. I thought, ultimately, that Stony Brook would be that kind.
I I think I understood that. I also understood the fact that there were some perceived shortages in New York, particularly in rural areas and in the central city. And that there wasn't probably a remarkable foresight in putting an institution in association with a university center. This kind of design, and the fact that when we came here, we understood that we wanted to make this a school, a medical school, certainly with responsibilities and involvements that reached from the city line to Montauk and Orient Point, was to be a sort of example to other underserved areas, in a sense, of how one could provide first-rate medical care to an area that was not provided for, and that wasn't simply sending another two physicians in or another three physicians in or getting people to move to rural areas, but really establishing a center of attraction. And it's surprising how even in this affluent county, how much was required to really provide first-rate medical care. It just wasn't here.
Well, Suffolk was exporting about 800 people a year for tertiary care in New York City.
And a lot of the care that was being given out here that was termed secondary properly belonged in a university hospital. However, that was an admission that was given us, and I think we fulfilled it in another way too. It was my understanding that we would try and recruit the existing medical people out here to the teaching effort, because there's no better way to learn than to have them teach. Indeed, when I try to conceive of programs in continuing education, one of the most effective programs is to require a physician to teach, because there's nobody who can shoot you down in flames faster than a medical student if you're not really up on what happened last week in the New England Journal of Medicine. And that has happened in part, not as thoroughly as one would want, because we were a little naive about the difficult geographic difficulties. This was an area that was very widespread. We're talking about 100 miles end to end. We managed to avoid a lot of the town gown struggle that attended the establishment of new schools in the 60s when they were being founded all over the country. Although we had a little bit of that.
I think Ed did a good job. Ed was aware of it. Of the problem.
Well, he had a knack of immediately understanding what individuals and people in different settings required, and he probably promised them that. Some of it was extraordinary. For instance, there was talk at the outset that students would come here for 2 years, come to the university center for 2 years, and then be sent out to hospitals, and the rest of their training would take place there. And the model being the English college hospital. The English university training takes them through basic sciences, and then they go off to Guy's or the St. Bartholomew's. And their diploma reads from the hospital, and that was sort of what Ed had hinted at, that they would be graduates not of State University of New York, but rather of the State University of New York Stony Brook, parentheses, Long Island Jewish Hospital. Or, well, when we started to recognize what it was we had to do to maintain surveillance and to control this enterprise, it became clear that that was not, they were all feasible, and so these hospitals had to be disabused of that.
You had to have some hospital make use of the hospitals until you could get your own, couldn't you?
That's right, but we could not, we couldn't, it turned out that we couldn't expect that the hospitals with their, with the staffing they had and the busy practitioners could provide the kind of central direction and curriculum design and surveillance and maintain the standards that that would properly belong to the, as a responsibility of the school. Also, that the students would opt for pediatrics at one place and obstetrics and gynecology at another place and internal medicine at another place. And we did have a lot of help from the community hospitals. That was an important part of our initial start. We could not have begun without them. We didn't open the hospital until 1980, I guess, and the school had been in existence for 9 or 10 years by that time. So we needed these hospitals desperately, and of course, every physician envisages himself as a professor. They had to have a little help in fulfilling that role. Now, the Stony Brook, when I came here a little enamored of the idea, too, that, my God, I said, I came from a medical school which was off campus, and we never saw the people in the undergraduate and graduate schools because we were the distance between Washington Square and NYU and 34th Street, and where the medical school was, 28th to 34th Street, was impassable. There was no interchange at all. I said, now I'm going to be on a campus with professors of English, archaeology, Romance languages. It's going to be such an invigorating experience. Well, it is, in a sense, except I'm afraid I never got to spend as much time with them. And indeed, one of the pleasant experiences I've had here is serving on committees in which there has been an interchange with people in natural sciences and people in arts. But we can do more of it. And just in passing, I might say that one thing that I felt very strongly, I said this to John Toll, I said it to the interim presidents, I said it to Marburger repeatedly, is that the medical school ought to play a role in the education of undergraduates.
That's a good idea.
There is no way in which one can graduate an individual and say that this is an educated individual without some insights into modern biomedical science, one, but also into certain parts of medicine which impinge directly now on daily life, decision making. One can't pick up a newspaper every day of the week in which there isn't some new cause of cancer, or some new cure for this disease or that disease, and this educated people should be sophisticated enough to be able to evaluate this. And I believe that we're searching for a role in education.
In liberal education.
Liberal education.
That's right. That's a good point.
Now,
let me just take a look at this.
See how far we've gone.
Campus.
Leadership on the campus.
Well, of course, I was always impressed with, and one of the reasons I was willing to come here was that I was always found Ed to be exciting and stimulating. Didn't always agree with him, and I was in the fortunate position of having been senior to him at At Bellevue, so I was one of the people who could tell him with no restraints that he was, I thought he was wrong or that this wouldn't work or something. So we had a very happy relationship and have continued to have it ever since he, even when after he left, I've been in contact with him frequently, and it's been very gratifying. Arthur Upton, I did not know except by reputation, and I had served on one national committee with him before I came here, but he's an extraordinary person. I've said at times that I think Arthur is probably the closest thing to a saint I've ever met. He is just so considerate and so thoughtful. Come on. Yeah. And so I have high regard for him, and he is an outstanding scientist as well. Meticulous very well organized and very intense. So I foresaw nothing but a delightful association with him. When I got here, I must say, and as I continue to work here, one of the people who impressed me and continues to impress me and who I thought was one of the beau ideals of the college president is John Chauvin. I was very appreciative of his support. I thought he was a determined and stubborn leader who knew what he wanted and understood quality. And I would hope, counted among his real admirers. In 1974, I was offered the Mallinckrodt Professorship of Pathology at Harvard, and John was very disturbed and said, "Well," he said, "I don't know what we could do to get you to stay here, but maybe I understand you live in Huntington, and maybe we could give you an apartment that's Sunwood." And so he showed me the apartment that he had formerly occupied there.
Oh, yes, the South Wing.
Yeah, and I said, "Well, I don't think that would be quite." And John said, "That's not what's going to keep you here, John. It's going to be the fact that I've run a large philology department. That isn't what's going to keep you here. It's the challenge of being part of this new place." And I decided to stay. I have not regretted for a minute, just as I've not regretted coming here for a minute from England. So John was the president, and he fulfilled all my expectations of what one could expect from a president. Perhaps the fact that we were new and developing was helpful. There is a certain tension always that develops between the medical school and the president of the university. It's expressed by, and there was a wonderful president of Indiana, I think, Flynn was his name, who once I heard say he never quite understood his medical school. Then he realized it was just like his football team. He said there were a lot of strange people milling around. He said the alumni took an inordinate interest in it. He says a lot of money changed hands. And they smell the same. Well, I think college presidents very often have that kind of limited understanding of what medicine is in university settings, simply because there's such a importance that has to be given to its service role, apart from teaching and research, which goes on in every department in a school, in a university. The idea is that you can't decide that we're not going to give neurology this year, like you can decide we're not going to give Latin 23. And you can't wait for blood in the blood bank the way you can wait for a shipment of textbooks to come in. It's a different sense. There's a sense of urgency and an involvement in an interest on the part of the people in the medical school on how every penny is spent, because it means so much ultimately to their patients. And that's hard for college presidents to understand. Well, we didn't have that sense with Toll because he was part of the startup of this business.
I've heard, and of course witnessed to a certain extent, what was supposed to be friction between Johnny and Ed, primarily on a matter of relative responsibilities and what financing requirements came first as far as the limited pot that existed up in Albany. It seems to me that Johnny was doing what he could, and Ed was doing what he could, and there were frustrations, not necessarily located here, but up